When a person kills another, everyone wants to know why, a motive. But the murderer cannot explain, even refuses to. Time passes and people forget the original crime, but the murderer does not. They even revel in it by giving themselves a nickname. We may never know what tipped them over the edge the first time. We will also never know what tipped them again over 22 years later when they go on to become a serial killer. This is the case of William Spengler, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
Thank you to Cherie for upping a Patreon pledge. Thank you very much.
I know I am behind with our extra content on Patreon, but I have two or three partially done. The research is tough, but I promise they are coming. And we have another Christmas episode for you. One I've never heard about. No documentaries, no books, not even a podcast or YouTube. Nothing except the odd news report anywhere. Multiple broken links, nothing in the Wayback Machine, and really hard to find anything. So I do apologise for the gaps in my knowledge. The reason this case is only remembered by locals and people in the emergency services is probably the fact that it occurred just 2 weeks after the Sandy Hook massacre and was completely, understandably, buried underneath that case. Let me start with a family tree. It's setting the scene and relevant, and thanks to Find a Grave for filling in some gaps. We start with Rose Hannah Hames, also known as Grandma, okay? She was born in Canada in 1888. She, at some point, married a chap called Aloysius J. Spengler, a.k.a. Granddad. He was a toy boy, being born in 1889 in Rochester, New York. They have one child, a son called William H. Spengler, a.k.a. Dad, born in 1922 in Rochester. So that says to me that's where the family settled initially. Dad marries Arlene G. Pegish, also known as Mum at some point. She was born in New York in 1921, another one who liked a toy boy. They actually have two children. Cheryl, known as Sherry, I believe, born in 1945, and William H. Jr., born in 1950. Both these children, Sherry and William, were born in Webster, Monroe County, New York, which is where this case is set. Webster is a town, but described as a middle-class suburb of Rochester. It's got about 43,000 residents, sits on the shore of Lake Ontario. I bet it's cold in winter. Nan and Granddad settled in Webster too, right next door to Mum, Dad and their grandchildren. Neither grandchild ever seems to marry. Sherry reads like a homebody, worked as a secretary, liked to garden, had friends. William, I'm not sure what he did find mention of him working in food prep. I'll explain that phrase later. Granddad dies in 1967, aged 78. Nan carried on living next door until 1980. 18th of July, 1980. William Jr. would have been around 30 at the time, was at Grandma's. According to him, he was trying to nail the cellar door shut to keep Grandma from going down there and to keep her safe. She was 92 by this point, possibly getting rather doddery, maybe a bit of dementia settling in. They get into an argument, never explained about what. Grandma punches or hits William Jr. in the family jewels. That hurts, obviously. William doesn't slap her or restrain her. He doesn't even hit her back as such. He beats her to death with the hammer he was holding. The story is not clear because records are not online, but I have read descriptions stating that her head was beaten to an absolute pulp. not just one hit to get her off. It reads like a complete loss of control. Why he had such a reaction, we will never know.
I mean, you got hit in the nuts.
Yeah.
It seems like a slightly disproportionate response, but fuck around and find out.
Yeah. He's never able to explain it. He's charged with murder. Then, as the family want to put it behind them, it's downgraded to manslaughter. He is sentenced in 1981 to 25 years with the possibility of parole. I do not know when he went up for the parole board, but at one hearing, when he is asked why he did it, he has no answer. It's not that response that puts the parole board off. It's the fact that William Jr. will not engage with the programs that he's supposed to do when in prison. I don't know, but I'm guessing anger management and some others. He actually went before the parole board 4 times, and 3 times they were worried he would kill again. During a parole hearing in 1989, he told the board that he got along fine with his grandmother. When asked why he had killed her 8 years earlier, he responded, "I still haven't figured that out. It was a matter of just wanting to get out." When asked if he would kill again, William responded, "That's the thing that does worry me. If you were capable of it once, are you capable of it again?"
In the right circumstances, I would say yes. Is there any history of abuse from him? Not from him, but to him, from grandmother, grandparent, anything?
Not that I'm aware of.
Again. So it seems to be just a violent outburst because he got hit in the nuts, basically.
Yeah. 17 years pass. William goes before the parole board again and is released under supervision and returns home to mum, dad and his sister in 1997.
How old is he when he gets sentenced?
He would have been 31.
And he gets released 17 years later.
Yeah.
So around the 48 mark. Prior to him being sentenced, and I'm going to ask again, because past actions are usually indicative of future actions to a degree.
Yes.
Do you have a record at all?
No, not that I'm aware of. But again, nothing online. And this got buried. There's scant information out there.
If there was something, it would have probably come up, though.
Yeah, I would have thought it would have done.
He only got 17 years, or he got changed to manslaughter. Is that because the family didn't want to press anything further?
The family was the reason for it, manslaughter. He got 25 years, but with parole, and he gets let out after 17 years on parole.
Assuming good behaviour, or are you going to get into it?
I'm assuming good behaviour, or it was one of the cases that the prisons were overcrowded and, you know, he hasn't done anything really bad in all these years, out he goes. Even though he hadn't complied with the training programmes that they'd wanted him to do when he was in prison. Anyway, the reason for the family tree at the beginning was I didn't understand people saying that William Jr. inherited Grandma's house. I don't think he did. His father would have been the sole heir. 2002, Dad dies. William and his sister are still living with Mum. William adores his mum, hates Sherry. We do not know why. My gut says that Dad forgave Junior for killing his own mother. You know, Grandma was difficult, etc., etc. Mum, he was the golden boy. And sister Sherry was bastard killed Granny. I think it was around that point that Mum adds both Sherry and William to the property deeds, possibly an inheritance tax thing. It's from property records that I got William Jr.'s occupation was food preparation and serving related occupations.
That's broad. That could be working in McDonald's. That could be a chef. That could be anything.
Yeah.
That is basically just I worked with food.
During the trial for killing Granny, or the sentencing for that, I came across a mention of him having a spotty work history. So I don't think he'd ever been a captain of industry.
Well, it's difficult to have a full career when you spent 17 years in prison.
This was before he battered Granny.
True. Mm. Also, I want to add, I don't blame Sherry for thinking he's the one that killed Grandma. I don't like him.
No.
it's a fair chip to have on your shoulder. Also, yep. Cherie, who upped their pledge on Patreon, is getting real mileage out of the name in this, but it's not in a good light somehow. I know it's spelt different.
2006, William stays out of trouble the whole of his probation, and so it's signed off. To all intents and purposes, he is now a free man. Remember I said at the beginning about a nickname? He never hid it from the neighbours, would quite happily introduce himself to them as your friendly neighbourhood criminal and other such monikers. They all knew about Grandma and what he'd done, and they all liked him. Nice, ordinary guy. Rehabilitated, yes. Obviously not, or else we wouldn't be here, even given with Granny being murdered.
Thing is, though, if he's been perfectly nice and amicable and just a normal neighbour, depending on the relationship between the households, when he was younger, at the age of 30-something, when he's killed his grandmother, they might have a positive outlook on him, and then he's gone to prison and come back, and what he did has kind of faded away through time.
The new neighbours didn't know him from previously.
But if he's introducing himself as Hammer Magoo, you're going to have a... It's gonna. If that's the first time I've met you...
Yeah.
The first impression is pretty big, especially when it's I'm the neighbourhood criminal.
He has a strange relationship with the neighbours. It's very, very odd, and I'll get into that. It was one of those oh moments when I fell over it.
Also, wouldn't you want to be friends with the neighbourhood criminal, because then you're probably safer?
Yeah, you would have thought
you're
so.
Better being the nutter on the bus, because then everyone leaves you alone.
Yeah. Well, one of these neighbours was a young woman called Dawn. Dawn and her whole family are close with William Jr. He is actually known to them as Uncle Billy. And one of the sons thought he had a crush on their mum because he was round every single day. Dawn and William go to a gun shop in Henrietta, a suburb of Rochester, in June of 2010. They must have looked like grandfather and granddaughter. He was 61, she was 22. They select a couple of guns and Dawn fills in the forms to buy them. Yes, William is an ex-felon, so not allowed to own guns. Dawn then became what is known as a straw purchaser.
Is she aware that he's a felon?
Yes, fully aware. Dawn paid $1,425.58 with $1,500 cash provided to her by William to purchase two firearms for him, and he chose them. A Bushmeister .223 caliber semi-automatic rifle and a Mossberg 12-gauge shotgun. I did get my hands on some court records. Dawn told a couple of porkies. She said she didn't use marijuana and that she was the actual buyer of the firearm. Big no-no on both counts, lying on a federal form. It's never explained why William Jr. wanted those guns. I'm pretty sure no one is going hunting with a semi-automatic rifle, and it doesn't appear Dawn ever asked, or if she did, she never admitted the reason. That is 2010. He doesn't get into any trouble. Everything is just ticking along until October 2012, when Mum, Arlene, dies. There's no hint of anything untoward. She was 91 by this point. Ironic to me, it was almost the same age as Granny that Junior had murdered. There is possibly a hint of what was to come in Arlene's obituary. No one seems to know why, and the remaining family are not telling, and I don't blame them one bit, but it's stated that the memorials may be directed to West Webster Firemen's Association, in brackets, Ambulance Fund. As far as my research is able to see, the family had no link with that association, but it's entirely possible it's just something his mother was passionate about. 2 months, William and Sherry continued to share that house. It's almost 1,400 square foot, so a reasonable size. They hate each other with a passion by this point and basically live on separate sides of the house. It's a situation that will end only one way. 5:35 a.m. on the 24th of December 2012, 911 get a call to say that the house at 191 Lake Road, Webster, is on fire. That's William Jr. and Sherry's home. Joseph Hofstetter was a fireman heading into work, and he hears this come over the radio and does what a lot of emergency services people do. He heads straight towards the trouble. He pulls up in front of the house and realises that the car in front of the house is also on fire. As he arrives, Michael Chiaperini and Theodore Scardino, who are also in the fire department, also arrive. Michael is actually a public liaison officer with the fire department, but worked as a volunteer firefighter. It's Christmas Eve. They're probably on a skeleton crew. As Michael and Theodore pull up, Joseph gets out of his vehicle and walks up to theirs. They are immediately shot at. At the same time they are coming under fire, Thomas Kozlowski arrives on the scene. He's only 19. A dispatcher is his day job, but he also volunteers as a firefighter. It's dark. They have no idea where the shots are coming from, but think it's from the house. So Michael and Theodore pile out of the truck on the passenger side, unknowingly directly into the line of fire that was coming from what was called a berm on the other side of the street. Had to look berm up. It's got at least seven meanings, but all equate to a narrow ledge, specifically in a space of ground or a terrace from 3 to 5 feet in width. Think a raised bank or path, especially the bank of a canal opposite a towpath. And this makes sense if you think that this town is on the banks of the lake. You have Michael and Theodore unknowingly now directly in the line of fire. Michael is shot in the head and Theodore is shot in the back of his shoulder. Theodore manages to crawl under the vehicle and plays dead and still manages to get shot again as the bullets are flying. He takes another round to his leg. Joseph gets shot in his lower back and in his pelvis. Thomas had just pulled up into a war zone. He gets out of his vehicle, not knowing what on earth is going on, and gets shot and killed as he's walking towards where Michael and Theodore are. It's William Jr., of course, that's shooting at them. William isn't finished. He throws 2 makeshift petrol bombs at the fire department truck that's sheltering Theodore and shoots at the bottles, trying to make them explode. That is an insane level of hatred, isn't it? Joseph is made of tough stuff, though. Despite his injuries, the bullets in his back and pelvis, he crawled to the driver's side door of the truck and manages to radio the approximate location of the shooter and to alert other responding personnel to the danger. We are now almost at Superman level as Joseph, hanging out of the driver's side door, was able to drive the fire truck using his left hand to press the gas pedal whilst he steered with his right hand, approximately 150 feet away from the house before the fire truck crashed, and he managed to get into his own vehicle and drive away. Theodore is stuck under the fire truck. He can't move. SWAT arrives and immediately start trying to track down the shooter, William, and secure the scene. Poor Theodore is stuck for 90 minutes until he is rescued. Michael and Thomas are confirmed dead at the scene. That's a whole lot of therapy needed. Responders hear one more gunshot at around 5:58 a.m., less than half an hour after the incident started. There were reports from a woman doing that early morning dog walk who said that she had seen a vehicle speeding away from the area at what she estimated to be about 90 miles per hour. No idea if that's true or not. It is not made clear from multiple sources where they find William Jr., but they do track him down a few hours later after the shootout. He had killed himself with a revolver. Three guns were found with him. Two of them were the ones he had bought with Dawn, and there's mention of a revolver in many articles and the legal papers I read, and it's identified as a 38 caliber.
Can I go on a limb and ask, is that the granddad's or something?
No idea. Nobody seems to know where he got this gun from. It's America. As SWAT were on site and the fire department were unable to respond, not least probably because half the force was either in the morgue or in hospital, no one could put the fire out at William's house. It spread. That house was burnt to the ground almost, and the fire also completely destroyed six other homes, with two more being badly damaged. It's 11:30 a.m. before they can begin to dampen down the fires. That is at least 12 families impacted by William's early morning rampage. And for what? There are some news reports still available online where the local police chief gives a bit of information. They find some sort of manifesto, two or three pages. They do not release it because it is evidence. And although I looked far and wide, unless someone has used the FOIA to get a copy, it's never been published in full. The police chief only quotes one line. I still have to get ready to see how much of the neighbourhood I can burn down and do what I like doing best, killing people.
I've got a question about something before. You said that six houses, mm-hmm. and then here's making seven?
Yes.
Was anyone else harmed in those six houses? Because you said 12 families and so it all were.
Well, they were displaced. Then you've got all the families.
But I'm wondering, direct harm, as in anyone killed by that?
No.
No. I'm surprised by that. House fires are like a high casualty type experience.
It's 6 a.m. as it's going up. But then I suppose they would have had...
They would have had the gunfire. That's alerting
and all
everyone.
The alarms and everything.
The sirens,
so, yeah. By that point, everyone realises that Sherry, William's sister, is missing too. They eventually find her body in the burnt out house. She had been shot in the head with the bullets showing it's the revolver. Everyone is in shock, of course. No one has any answers as to why. What set him off? Was there an argument with Sherry? That letter is typewritten. PC or manual, it doesn't say, but it's not a suicide note, according to the police chief either. And it doesn't explain why he did this, just what his intent was. Four people dead, including the shooter. Two more in hospital, critically injured. I think in ICU for a bit too. Seven houses burnt down with two more uninhabitable. So now what? Dawn. When they find William's body and the guns, obviously they can trace them by the numbers. They go and talk to Dawn. She panics, obviously, and tells them that the guns have been stolen from her. No police report. Love, try again. She actually texted an ATF officer that same night and admitted buying the guns for William.
Could there have been any excuses if she's had to buy it under duress or threat of violence? Could that have been any excuse, or is it like a statutory offence? Doesn't matter what the circumstances are, you sold a gun to a felon.
I believe it's a statutory, regardless, yeah.
I know it gets weird if you say you've never done drugs or whatever, you then buy a gun, and then there's someone finds evidence of you talking about getting higher when you were like 18. They can use that as you lying on the form, and then that's now a federal offence, and that's a big deal.
Yeah, I believe there was no
defence. There's no excuse, no. Okay.
28th of December, Dawn is arrested and charged with knowingly making a false statement in connection with the purchase of a firearm from a federal firearm licensee, and a few other charges all relating to her knowingly doing this for a felon. Dawn was convicted in April 2014 and in May of 2015 was sentenced to 96 months or 8 years. Now, you may wonder at that sentence, and you would then be in the same place as her lawyers. The government admitted at trial that they didn't believe that Dawn knew what William intended to do with the guns. Dawn's lawyers appeal in 2015 and state that her sentence was 500 times the maximum midpoint of the sentencing range for such a crime. They had expected 18 to 24 months if convicted.
Is that because the consequences of her doing it were so grave?
Nobody really knows why she got the sentence she did. I think, yeah, probably. And also as well, because it's firefighters that were killed.
That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
If you shot at the police, I kind of understand. But shooting at the firefighters, no one ever made a song called Fuck the Firefighters.
Well, there you go. And remember me saying that William's note was never released? It wasn't, but it figured very heavily in the appeal, which I now have sight of some of it. This is where it gets really confusing. Dawn's mother is also called Dawn. I will use her surname because that's what William called her, Welsher. Although everyone says that William was sweet on her mother, Welsher, and was really tight with Dawn, he completely and utterly throws her under the bus in his manifesto note thing that he leaves. I'm going to give you multiple quotes from that document because it says some very different things to all the news reports. William's typed, single-spaced, 2.25-page note demonstrated his substantial familiarity with Welsher and her family and with Welsher's affairs. William referenced Welsher's father, stepfather, brother and children, and two insurance settlements that she had received, including one for the pool. I have no clue what pool it's referring to. And said that she received money from SSD for mental health issues. Assume that's some sort of social security. Virtually the entire note consists of his efforts to persuade law enforcement to arrest Welsher for her schemes and states that she is responsible for the straw purchase. I got the Bushmeister and the Mossberg cruiser from Welsher for cost plus $1,000. But she sent her daughter to get them because she doesn't like to leave a paper trail. Needless to say, her daughter isn't the brightest person in the world and went for whatever bullshit story Welsher gave her. So the dummy will take the heat for the weapons while the person who set it up made the profit skates. William urged for the right one to take the hit. On the one hand, you have the daughter who is going to school to try and make something of herself and was basically duped, and the low-life mother who sent her to get them.
Why do I feel like old Dawn's catching strays in his little manifesto note there?
Yeah.
He's basically admitted to manipulating her.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm surprised she got sentenced to 9 years when he said, yeah, I manipulated and lied, all this other stuff. Because then she doesn't have the intent quite the same.
Exactly. And also as well, that last line about the daughter who's going to school to try and make something of herself, that sounds quite...
Well, it could almost actually be considered as like a character statement. Like she's a good person making something of herself, but despite that, I can still manipulate her into getting me guns.
Well, I think he's talking about Dawn's other sister, but it really doesn't seem like he liked any of them at all. The appeal document also revealed that Welsher stated in mid-2007, which was about 3 months after she moved into the house next door, she heard that William had killed his grandmother and asked him about it. William admitted that he'd served 17 years in prison for killing his grandmother with a hammer, telling Welsher he'd do it again. He said killing was no big deal to him. It was like turning a light switch on and off to him. Welsher also told the police that in 2008 or 9, William stated that when his mother died, he was going to kill Cheryl. He was going to take her and pull her in the lake with bricks. So he'd been talking about killing his sister for about 5 years.
I'm surprised that relationship can be reconciled. He must be able to understand why Sherry hates him for killing the grandmother.
I don't think he cared. Genuinely don't think he cared. I think there was something was broken in this guy and I've got no idea why.
It seemingly comes out of the blue though, because he's been like a normal person.
Seemed
up until the point of when he killed his grandmother, and that was... While I don't agree with it, I can understand his motivation for it because he just got hurt at the time, so he's lashed out. And
yeah.
That's why I don't believe the light switch thing, because if that was the case, he's only killed one person that we know of at that time.
Well, they're beside Lake Ontario, aren't they? I've heard some stories about how many bodies there are in the bottom of Lake Ontario, so I don't know. I can't share these appeal documents. It's a download again. But if you go digging in the weird corners of the internet, you will find it. And I can't find anything after that. I think the appeal was unsuccessful. And to be honest, from what I read, Dawn was very lucky not to have actually been charged as a co-conspirator, as that was what many of the victims' families and survivors wanted. And that puzzled me, as it was a few years after buying the guns, and I wasn't sure how long after an event you could be considered as a co-conspirator. But it explains what I found next. A lawsuit from 2014, where all the victims' families and the survivors sued the gun shop, Dawn, and the estate of William Jr. The basis for that suit was, given the circumstances of the purchase, Gander Mountain, the gun dealer, knew or should have known and should have taken steps to confirm that William and not Dawn was the actual purchaser and intended end user of the guns, and that the sale to Dawn, a straw purchaser, was illegal. Basically, it boiled down to them being negligent. And I wondered why or how. The court papers revealed that they felt that Gander Mountain staff should have realised that Dawn was buying on William's behalf. They didn't buy any ammo either, and that alone was odd, maybe. But these are experienced gun sellers. I don't know how common it would be to challenge a sale. Then I found out that there is a formal recommended sales protocol. Gun dealers should screen suspicious purchasers with a battery of questions beyond those required by federal law.
But she has to be considered suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And was she up until that point?
I don't know.
That's the argument about the due diligence, because they could have done the due diligence and the outcome is still bad.
Yeah. It's also part of these rules that these gun dealers are not allowed to sell firearms to a person unless the dealer has no doubts about the legitimacy of the sale, even if the purchaser is not prohibited by federal or state law from buying guns. So if someone looks at you a bit cross-eyed, I'm not selling you. But Gander Mountain knew or should have known about this program, and it's referred to as "Don't Lie for the Other Guy." The estate of William that was being sued, well, there were a number of cousins. There were family left. Someone would have inherited whatever was going. The house or its remains was swiftly pulled down. I found a vacant lot, but no idea if it was sold. Dawn had nothing. I have no idea what happened to that case. I suspect it was probably settled by insurance. I have to say, I have no idea if it means the same in the USA, but gander, whilst being a male goose, also means in slang to have a look at. Take a gander at this. The name of the gun shop is one of the few chuckles in this case. What this case did do for the betterment of society, I think, is made sure some legislation was put in place that in 2013, as part of a NY Safe Act, the New York Penal Law section on aggravated murder was amended to increase penalties for murdering a first responder. It's called the Webster provision, and it's moved it to life in prison without parole. The case is also known as the Webster 2012 shooting, and that's because there's another one in the small town. 15-year-old Michael Pilato in 2011, and again at Christmas. That case was second-degree murder, attempted murder, murder by arson and arson. According to the police, Pilato poured gasoline throughout his Webster home and set it ablaze in December 2011, killing his 71-year-old father, Carmen, and his brother, 16-year-old Peter and 12-year-old Josh. His mother and 13-year-old sister managed to escape the fire, but both had injuries relating to the accident. According to his mother, she believed Pilato may have been under the influence of bath salts or synthetic marijuana on the night that he set the fire. Meanwhile, a therapist who had treated Pilato for 4 years referred to him as a budding sociopath in his pre-sentence report. His mother also defended him by saying that in all the years Pilato received treatment, he was never diagnosed as a sociopath, suggesting there was no sign he could behave in such a manner. Mums, eh? He was charged as an adult. He got 15 to life, and that says to me that that psychiatric report says he's far more dangerous than Mum thinks he is. And that is the end of this week's episode. A serial killer, a spree killer, and someone I had not heard of. Finally, the victims who should not be forgotten. Rose, aged 92. Sherry, aged 67. Michael, aged 43. And Thomas, aged 19.
And that is the end of another episode of the Murder Me Monday podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Please like, favorite, subscribe, all that good stuff. If you really enjoyed it, please consider checking us out on Patreon. That would be nice. If you're on the Patreon, hang about. We're doing the case autopsy. And as always, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday podcast. Peace.
Bye.